This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by CashFly.
This episode of Know-How is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/know-how and entering the promo code KNOWHOW. Today on Know-How,
it's CES 2017.
Welcome to Know How. It's a Twitch show where we build, bend, break, and upgrade. I am Father Robert Ballister.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And guess what, Brian? We're not in the studio today. I know it's hard to believe, but yeah, we're not there.
Something feels a little different. And I'm kind of exhausted.
Yes, but it's been a long couple of days. We don't smell tremendously great, but what we do have is a great wealth of knowledge about the tech here at CES. What used to be called the Consumer Electronics Show.
It's just CES now,
right?
Now
it's just CES. Yeah, you just drop all the additional. It's, you know, it's lighter. It's
right.
Easier to carry. It's mobile.
That's the cool thing this year, right?
Yeah. We have seen a couple of trends, and if you want to see all the trends, you can watch it at the CES special, twit.tv/specials. But, you know, quite briefly, we've seen a lot with cars, a lot with automation, a lot with connected vehicles. But I'd say the winner of the trend of the show has to be the assistant, specifically Alexa.
Alexa's
in everything.
It's so far integrated into all the stuff here that there's actually a toaster that you can activate with Alexa. Like, I guess it's becoming ubiquitous that if you want to talk to something, it's going to be through the Alexa interface.
Right. And that's not to say that Amazon has won the assistant war, but when we look at the number of devices out there that are running Alexa, from LG and Samsung TVs to their hubs to GE with their light bulbs to headphones and, yes, toasters and appliances that have Alexa, it would seem that Amazon has leveraged their head start of the field to really kind of give them a competitive advantage.
Yeah, I think it definitely shows how much of an advantage they have being the first ones out and also kind of opening up their platform to a lot of these different services that these third-party vendors can take advantage of.
Now, what we want to do for the next couple of minutes is we want to show you some of the sights and the sounds of CES. We've been everywhere, from CES Unveiled to Showstoppers to Digital Experience, and yes, throughout all of the show halls here at the LVCC and at the Sands. Without further ado, you know what I want to do?
I want to
start with an update to one of the best devices of CES 2016.
Oh, so pretty.
It's so pretty. Let's head over to Razer. If you remember our coverage from CES 2016, you think you know what this is, but you have no idea. We're here at the Razer booth, and yes, this was one of my favorite entries for last year's edition of the big Consumer Electronics Show. I'm sorry, we don't call that anymore. This is the Razer Blade Stealth. This wonderful little ultrabook really stole our heart because it was fast, it was beautiful, and it was way less expensive than all of its competitors. Now, last year they had this 4K screen, same beautiful 4K screen, same i7 processor, same overall look, but they've upped the spec. Now they've got twice as much memory at 16 gigabytes. They've got twice as much storage space as a 1 terabyte, not a standard SATA 3 SSD, but a PCIe connected SSD, and that same 14-inch plus 4K screen. It's absolutely gorgeous. Now, for I/O, you're going to get two USB 3.0 plus one USB-C port that doubles as the power port, as well as the audio adapter and your HDMI. So you're really, really, well, set for pretty much every situation you might have to be in. It's only going to weigh about 2.5 pounds. It's only going to be about 1/2 inch thick. And here's the best thing. They've kept it at the same price point. That's right. The revamped Razer Blade Stealth with the Kaby Lake processor, i7, is going to run you $999. I still don't know how they do that. I didn't know last year, and I still don't know how they keep that price point so low. It's also going to support, through that USB-C port, the dock. So if you're looking for a little extra oomph when you're home, something that won't drain your battery when you're on the go, you can connect a full-size video card to this thing and be gaming in the standard Razer experience. Now, if you are looking for an Ultrabook, yes, there are a lot of them on the market, and I love some of the ones from Acer and some of the ones from Dell and from HP, but for the pure gaming stylish experience, if you like matte black, you got to get a Razer. In the world of LED TVs, there's thin and then there's LG thin. I'm standing here with James, who's going to talk about the W series of OLED TVs from LG. James, this is unbelievable. These aren't just TVs that are thin. I mean, they're basically just the film itself. Tell me about the W series.
Well, with the signature OLED, with the wallpaper, the benefit of it is the ultra slim design. You're looking at 0.2 inches. So literally, you're looking at just the panel mounted to your wall, going down to a Dolby Atmos soundbar, giving you that premium sound to go with the premium picture. So let's talk about a little bit of the setup on it. You're looking at the panel literally mounts directly to the wall with a magnetic plate, snaps in with a slight flexibility, one ribbon cable going down to the box, and everything is in the components, and all the AV is built into that box. So whether it be processing, that's why it is so thin, because you don't need anything in the TV. It's literally just panel.
All right, let's do some of the specs that we got to get out of the way, because our audience is very tech savvy. They're going to want to know, what's the resolution? How bright is it? Does it support HDR? Give me everything you can about what this TV can do.
Absolutely. So we're looking at a 4K HDR TV, and we upped the ante a little bit this year. Last year, we went with Dolby Atmos. We went with HDR 10. This year, we're going to be showing off some Technicolor HDR and some HLG in one of the other booths. That's going to give you all your four major HDR services. So you're getting that complex, pure contrast within that picture quality. Now, we added 25% bright luminosity to increase that brightness on it. So you're getting a higher contrast ratio with the TV and that HDR service.
Now, I do remember that OLED TVs tend to be ridiculously expensive. In fact, not too long ago, I saw a TV about half the size. But by the way, what size is this?
This one you're seeing is a 65-inch.
Okay, 65. I saw a 32-inch panel probably two CESs ago that was going for $15,000. So I'm almost afraid to ask you how expensive this is. How much am I going to have to shell out for a W series?
Well, it's some national retailers today. It went on pre-order for $8,000.
Okay, not bad at all. All right, now I got to ask a difficult question, and that is, I love this kind of technology. I think it's beautiful. I think it's brilliant. I love the colors. I love the fact that it's OLED. I love the fact that it's so thin. But who is this for? I mean, who does LG envision is going to be the buyer of a wallpaper series of TVs that you have to mount on the wall? Who is your demographic?
Well, there's a lot of people that like to mount, and this gives you an all-in-one mount. I mean, you're literally taking it out of the box, being able to put it on your wall, and getting that pure, perfect, including an art gallery-style design. In fact, there's a mode in here just to give it that appearance so it can look like that beautiful picture that you want on your wall. So if you're looking for elegance, that's exactly what this is going to give you.
I love it. Now, for the folks at home, if they wanted to find out more about the wallpaper series of TVs from LG, if they want to find out more about your OLED technology, where should they go?
Absolutely go to LG.com. We can give you more information. They can give you more specs. Everything is going to be on there. And you're going to be able to see this stuff as it gets talked about at CES. So definitely check it out.
James, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your technology. And the future is really, really big and really, really thin. When it comes to wireless speakers, there's been only one brand that I've trusted for the last 2 years, and that's Fugu. That's right. The speaker named after the funny little fish has been my go-to, not just wireless, but wired speaker because of its size, its portability, and, well, just the quality of the audio. That's why I'm standing next to Gary. He's the CEO of Fugu. He actually brought me in before the product was even released, and now he's got good news for all you Fugu fans out there. They've revamped the line, and you're going to love the new quality and price points. Gary, tell me, what has Fugu been doing over the last 12 months?
All right. Well, we've been working on building some really great products. First off, the main thing I'm going to talk about tonight is the Fugu Go. It's shipping now. You can get it at Sam's Club, and we'll take it to a bunch more places. It's about 80% louder than our previous generation at half the price, now at $99.99. And so some of the cool things you can do now, it's still, first off, waterproof, shockproof, mudproof, dustproof, IP67, 5 feet drops to concrete. It's just built to last. Now, this guy here, he's the only guy that I know of that took my speaker to the beach, buried it in the sand, gave it to his dog as a chew toy, threw it into the surf. Yeah, yeah. He may be ordained, but he's got a little evil streak to him too. All right.
I love the toughness, because you got to remember, the sand in San Francisco isn't just sand; it's fine iron particles, and that's why I knew it would be a true torture test. That kills most speakers. The Fugu didn't even blink.
I know. So we really build things to last. We really focus on quality. So hopefully everybody sees that as you have, and we'll keep going and doing some crazy things. So Fugu Go, first thing also, we do this mounting cord. So you can pull this off, mount it on the shower. You can mount it on a fence. Now the other thing you can do to it now, put it on a golf cart, on a stroller, dune buggy, ATV. Now at 80% louder, you can hear it anywhere outdoors. And it holds on like great. I took this on a dune buggy 2 weeks ago, 4 hours on a Razor. One speaker you could hear with helmets, and on the roll bar, worked great, all right? You can also pair two of them. So now you've got 80% louder times two. Killer, killer price points. You can do them in double and stereo mode, all right? 10-hour battery life. So there you go.
Now, you didn't just create a new mono speaker for the wireless system. Right. You've also taken the original, the one that I've loved so much. I'm going to call it the Fugu Classic, and you've made it bigger and you've made it louder. Yeah. If there was one drawback from the original speaker, it's that I love the quality, but sometimes in a big room, you know, you wanted a little more oomph. Right. So you're giving me the oomph. Tell me about these.
Sure. We're going to continue to build speakers that go after different segments. So for these are now the Style S and the Tough S. They'll be coming out in springtime. The key things we did was we heard people say, I'm outdoors. I really, really want it loud. So these are about 80, 90% louder with a really great sound to them. And you can pair these as well. So you can still drive a truck over them, waterproof, dustproof, mudproof. You can, you know, throw it in the ocean if you really need to, as this guy does. And they're just going to last for you. So that's Fugu S. Series coming out in spring. We'll talk more about it here in just a few months.
Gary, I got to say, normally I try to throw a couple of questions to everyone I interview to bring out the negatives, but sure. As a person who's actually bought these, not just for myself, but for gifts, I love the Fugu line. I think you've done really well, and I think they're an engineer speaker. Thank you very much for your time.
Always great to
Thank you for your tech. Tell them, where do they go if they want the best wireless speaker on the market?
Fugu.com, F-U-G-O-O.com, or the Go Anywhere Speaker Company. Take care, everybody.
There you have it. If you're looking for the best wireless speaker on the market, trust the one named after the poisonous fish. Here at CES, it's always been a tradition in the South Hall to have this. That's right. It's an array of massage chairs. These people are in nirvana as they get squeezed and threaded and rubbed and pulled in pretty much every direction by some of the most advanced technology on the floor. Which reminds me, we should probably talk about a sponsor of this episode of Know How that loves to do the exact same thing. Take technology and put it at the demands of your body. And of course, that sponsor is Casper. Now, most of us spend, at least if we're doing it right, at least 8 hours a night sleeping. I mean, that's what we should be doing. We understand that if we get less than that, bad things happen. That's when you get overweight. That's when your health gets bad. That's when things in your body go awry. So why is it that we spend so little time and really so little money on the thing that we're going to be spending so much time on top of? That's why Casper gives us a, well, I'd say, rigorously engineered mattress at a fraction of the cost of the big boys. You see, Casper mattresses are obsessively engineered. They are made of supportive memory foam for a sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, it's breathable. That means that sleep's cool. You're not going to wake up in the middle of the night soaked in sweat because your mattress was essentially hermetically sealing you. It's going to breathe in the right way while giving you the support that you need to get that good night's sleep without waking up sore. Now, here's the big thing. When you go into a showroom, which is the norm for buying a mattress, you're going to lie down on that mattress for what? 10 seconds, 30 seconds, maybe 2 minutes if the showroom manager is really nice. But that really has nothing to do with how that mattress is going to feel over the course of your life, over the course of its usage, over maybe 5, 10, 20 years. Casper does it differently. They're going to send the mattress to you so you can try it in your room, in the actual place that you're going to sleep, and you can decide for yourself is Casper is right for you. We've got Casper mattresses at Twit. In fact, Leo swears by it, and they love it because Casper understands the importance of truly trying out that mattress. They gave him a 100-day period, so he doesn't have to lie down in the showroom. He could try it out, and if he didn't like it, send it back for a full refund. And that's what they want to do for you. Casper mattresses uphold the highest environmental protection standards and are made in the United States of America. Free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. Folks, get better sleep now. Get a Casper mattress today. You can save an additional $50 towards a mattress purchase by going to casper.com/knowhow. That's casper.com/knowhow and entering the promo code KnowHow. Once again, that's Casper.com/KnowHow with promo code KnowHow. Terms and conditions apply, and we thank Casper for their support of KnowHow. There's been a lot of attention paid to 360 technology over the last few years, but what happens when you want to move it from being a gimmick, something that's visually interesting, to something that's actually professionally useful? That's why you need to take a look at Leica Geosystems. I'm speaking with Hugh, who's going to explain why this interesting camera on a stick is the next big thing for everyone who does design. Hugh, what is this?
So this is a 360 sensor that is taking a full spherical image, 150 megapixel spherical image, with an integrated infrared camera, and also doing a full laser scan, so creating a point cloud behind that spherical image.
Now, I understand what that is. I understand it's using a laser so that it can measure particular distances from the camera. I understand that the lens is going to be capturing an image in 360. I understand IR helps give me a little bit of depth, but why would I want to capture that information? It's interesting to geeks, but what use can I put that to?
Well, if I'm a building runner, if I do building construction, for example, and I would like to know exactly what I'm getting into when I start a project, I can set this BLK 360 up in a room. It takes about 3 minutes to do a scan. And then when I leave the job site, I have it all the points measured, not some of them, but all of them measured, so that I can even be back in my office, pull up that file, put myself in that space, and accurately measure the distance between the floor and the ceiling in the corner of the room, for example.
That makes sense. So it's not just the ability to zoom in and zoom out as we can with 360 devices and 360 imagery, but it's the ability to say, I need to have the relative distance between that point and that point because I'm thinking about putting a wall there. I mean, I could see being very useful.
I think you should work for our company. You said it better than I could.
All right. Now, once I have all of this information, what do I do with it? I mean, do I have to freeform sketch this, or is there a way for me to transform that into an actual model that will incorporate the distance, that will incorporate the IR information, and will incorporate the imagery?
Well, you bring up a very important point. So we create this point cloud in using a piece of software called ReCap from Autodesk, Reality Capture. That ReCap is used as a conduit to take that scan data into other various CAD components that Autodesk creates. Autodesk writes their software, sorry.
Very cool. Now, I know there's a large part of our audience who's looking at this and thinking, oh, that's interesting, but there's also some professionals who are watching this saying, this will shave hours, if not days, off of my job site work. Who is this designed for? And I'm almost afraid to ask, what would a setup like this set my company back?
Okay, well, so it's really set up for... There are many people, small and mid-sized contractors, that are already using this technology, but they're having a service provider do the work for them. And because the existing systems are a little too complex or a little too expensive. This system is roughly $16,000. So it's, put on a couple-year lease, something you can handle. But it brings the capability and the functionality to a new group of people who want to get started and want to take more control of their workflow.
And by the way, I should mention that if you were going to be doing this with professional, traditional survey equipment, that's actually not that expensive.
No, that's 16 grand is a bargain, let me tell you. I mean, if you watch like time scanners, or there's some programs on public television, or you see on CSI a lot on TV, those scanners that you might see there might be 50,000 plus. So this is really, I know it's crazy, but it's entry level. So,
Hugh, thank you very much for sharing your time and your technology. If they wanted to find out more about this, more about Leica Geosystems, where can they go?
They can go to blk360.autodesk.com.
There you have it, folks. If you are looking at doing some professional work with design, you could do it the old way, or you could do it with lasers. We haven't done a pure tech story tonight, so I thought we should start with Rohini. What if I told you that this was the backlight for your keyboard? No, this is not just the circuit trays. This is the actual circuitry, including the LEDs, micro LEDs that you would need to illuminate that next-gen keyboard. Well, I'm here with Nick, who's going to explain why their technology, their patented technology, might be in the making for your next big piece of tech. Nick, what am I looking at?
So here is one of our computer keyboard backlights using micro LEDs, which is they're the world's smallest commercialized LEDs.
People are going to look at this and they're going to say, no, that's just a circuit trace. That's not actually the LEDs. They don't see the LEDs here. How do you do this? How do you make this thin of a film and have all the technology embedded on it?
What it really comes down to is, so here you'll see just some standard blue tape. That has 20,000 LEDs on it. And we've developed our own patented robots and our software that actually can identify each little LED, and then it places it wherever we want. So on that circuitry, they're there. You can't see it there, but we have a factory now with our partner in China that's doing high-volume manufacturing. We've reduced thickness by 60%, and we've reduced power consumption by 93% to achieve the same brightness.
That's ridiculous. In fact, this little light you have right here, this can get as bright as our camera light, which is amazing. In fact, right now, I think you just blew out the video, but it's amazing what you can do. What is exactly micro LED technology? For the people who might be hearing this for the first time, what would be your easiest way to describe it to them?
Micro LEDs are same as LEDs, but they're just incredibly, incredibly small and unpackaged. So most often, LEDs are packaged with the lens, the leads, the whole stack up. And they're binned, picked, placed, identified which ones are what brightness. Our technology allows you to take them directly off blue tape and go from wafer to product. So we're skipping many steps, days of work, and lots of money as well, because now we've cut out this whole process just by simplifying it, to be honest.
All right, so of course, efficiency and density, but what are the other advantages of using a micro LED system?
You know, efficiency, density, I would just say from the whole supply chain, so the thinner the products even, I mean, we're talking that if you want to get really nerdy, think about making current LCD displays thinner. You now have more room in a ship that goes across the ocean that can deliver that many more products. So it impacts everything. You don't really think about it. But right now, I think the big one when we're moving into display is the ability to have little micro zones with LEDs behind the LCD, which that's never been able to be done in a truly micro fashion.
I have to ask. It sounds pretty astounding. Why haven't we seen or heard of this technology in mass before? I mean, this is literally the first time I've heard of micro LEDs. It sounds like a phenomenal piece of technology, and it sounds like you've got the process down. Why isn't it everywhere?
Yeah, it's incredibly hard. Like that's the answer, is Apple purchased a micro LED company very quietly. Facebook has purchased one, and these companies have never been able to produce because they're taking a route that's different than ours. And we may try and go there someday, but we think there is this massive market that they forgot about and our team has been very aware of. So for 3 years, we've been quietly developing and building this. And the background for our company is in keyboards. Our founders created the Force Sensing touchpad, and they created the world's thinnest keyboard. And so as soon as they got done with that and did their buyout after the exit, they thought through, well, what do we want to do next? And it was, well, let's thin it out again by reducing the light guide. And that's what brought us to this solution, which then once we figured it out for keyboards, for computers, it was then, wait a second, what about display? Thinner, brighter, denser, it's all the right pieces.
All right, Nick, so what's next? I mean, obviously, you want to get your technology into more and more products. Yep. You've got 42 patents. This is ready to go. What's the next stage for Rohini?
So next stage right now is that we're taking our one factory that does the keyboards. It should be about Q2. Hopefully, we'll see some products in the market. In the keyboard space, and then we'll be moving rapidly into the display. So that's our big jump that's coming up right now is it's the argument everyone's having right now, right? Everyone's talking about OLED versus LCD and what's going to happen. And we are in a very unique spot with a very unique technology to say, wait a second, LCD can compete. You just need to have the right solution. We call it Pixie, is what we call our technology when it's the micro LED with our robots. And I think in 2017, you'll watch us step into the display space pretty aggressively.
Fantastic. If people wanted to find out more about micro LEDs, more about where you're going to be stepping into the space, where should they go?
Rohini.com is one. Pixie.com follows this specific technology. Rohini's working on other micro LED technologies that will pop up new sites for that. But primarily Rohini.com. And we're on Twitter and Instagram.
Nick, thank you very much for speaking with us. Thank you for sharing your technology. That's Rohini, a really, really bright idea. We've seen robotics at CES in the past, but usually they're surrounded by some sort of safety cage because robots can't work with humans. Well, that all changes here at Bosch. I'm speaking with Franz. And Franz, what is your position at Bosch?
I'm director in Bosch, responsible for the collaborative robotic and for the IT shop floor solution, for our software solutions. And what I can show you here today is what we see here, collaborative robotic. What does it mean? Humans and robots work close together. What we have done for that is we developed an electronical sensor skin, and because of the sensor skin, the robot stops before touching the human. And that's the reason why it's allowed that the human and the robot can work together. What you see here is the APAS workstation. The human can do an identification on the table, then the table goes to the right position. The work introductions you can see here change to the right language for the worker. And then the general idea is that the human and the robot work together. The robot supports the human. He does the stupid pick and place. And the human do the complex stuff, easy to do an automation for if you have low volumes. And that's the point.
This is amazing because every time I've seen an industrial robot, there's always been a lot of caution because these are powerful machines that could do a lot of damage to the human body. Yeah. The fact that you've put the design work into making sure that can't happen, it's almost like the start of Asimov's law of robotics. This robot can do no harm. In fact, can you show us what happens if a human gets too close to the operating robot?
Follow me. So now I can show you the functionality of the electronical skin. You see here, I'm not close enough. You see 5 centimeters before he touched me, he stops. And then if I go away, you see he will restart. And then if I come close to him, he stops.
Oh, what about the little attachment at the bottom? I mean, could you get your finger stuck in there? Could it do some damage?
It's also safe. There is no force who can hurt your hand. It's also tested. We do this, and we have grippers who snapped inside if it touched the human. I can also do a demonstration for you if you want.
Yes, please. Better your fingers than mine.
But then we have to restart the robot. This is the difference to the skin. With the skin, I can only stop and can directly restart the robot. If you push in the gripper, then you have to reset the gripper, and then you need a manual restart. Yeah.
Okay, let's not do that. She's got work to do. Now,
but I think you believe.
I do believe. Now, this is very different. I mean, this is the start of Iron Man's the workshop, where he has robots who actually help him with his tasks.
Correct.
Where can you bring this technology? I mean, right now it's set up for an industrial setting, but does Bosch see this as something that will eventually end up in homes and small businesses?
Yeah, we're currently searching for each kind of business where the robot can support the humans, each kind of jobs you can imagine. And we have a lot of other ideas where we can do that, for example, in the food area and so on, where the robot can do some stuff and so on. A lot of different areas and business fields we want to go with this robot technology in the future.
Franz, thank you very much for speaking with us. Thank you for sharing this technology. If they wanted to find out more about Bosch, if they wanted to find out more about your robots, more about perhaps what this new assistive technology can do, where should they go?
To our Bosch APAS homepage.
Thank you very much. And I, for one, welcome our robotic overlords. You know, Brian, I've always kind of wanted a stabbing robot, and now that Bosch has figured out the laws of robotics, I guess that's not going to happen.
No. I think they're fans of Westworld. They saw how things can turn in an instant, so I'm glad that they're programming safety into these robots.
Yeah. One of the things that just fascinates me is last year we saw some industrial robots. They were making it into the SANS, the Innovation Pavilion, and very cool, incredible to see them actually in action, moving around huge pieces of equipment.
Right.
But they were all kept behind glass because
they're dangerous.
They're really heavy machinery.
Dangerous.
And you know what? A motor that can put out 500 pounds of torque doesn't really know the difference between bending steel and bending your tibia.
Right. And when you think back to when we did do that interview with the Google engineer who made the stabbing robot, he had made a big point that it was mapped. Like the movement was mapped. It wasn't dynamic. And if you stepped in the way of that robot arm, you weren't going to feel good after that.
Yeah. What Basha said off camera, of course, is they're also working on using not artificial intelligence, but deep learning to let the robots figure out what they're doing. So it can actually map the workspace. It's not just going from point point A to point B, dropping off gadget A on top of, you know, musket B. Right. It's actually saying, hey, he's got these tools. They're over here. This is probably what I should do. And once you start doing that with robotics, they actually become useful rather than cumbersome.
And then it gets really scary if they start talking to each other.
Doing
and
our
then
jobs.
Skynet is
Skynet,
next.
Skynet, folks, it's happening. It's happening now. Now, what we want to do is we want to end this special on a little something-something that we did with the good folks at Ford. Now, you may not think of Ford when you think of autonomous vehicles, but think of it this way. It's interesting to develop the technology. It's wonderful to look at the sensors and to figure out where we're going to be using them. But to actually have a company that knows how to build a car before they built the autonomous features, that's something special.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of a laser geek too. And the fact that they were able to show what the car was seeing around the car, like you could actually make out us doing the camera work next to the car. And you could see all the individual bodies around the car. I like that stuff.
Yeah. Without further ado, this is Ford. Of course, one of the big stories of CES has to be the rise of the self-driving or the assisted car. We can't talk about that without coming to Ford. That's why I'm speaking with James, who was, I'd say, the father of the autonomous assisted driving program at Ford. Sir, what has Ford brought to CES?
Well, what you're looking at behind you is our latest research vehicle. And on this vehicle, we've moved to sensors that are a little more production intent. And essentially, you know, we have to get out and do a lot of validation and testing to make sure our algorithms are, you know, robust and safe and reliable everywhere. And you're looking at the latest test vehicle in that fleet.
I'm glad you brought that up because coming from Silicon Valley, my company is immersed in an area where companies think that they can put out 5 or 6 alphas, a couple of betas, and just sort of work out the kinks as we go. The VC who have invested in this technology have realized that's not really the case when it comes to car. It kind of has to be perfect when it comes out. So what has Ford brought to this, you know, undoubtedly new field from the traditional automaking pedigree?
Well, you know, I'd like to point out that we started in 2004, literally right here in Las Vegas in an event called the DARPA Grand Challenges. So I've got 12 years working on this, and, you know, we have a lot of experience in algorithm development. And additionally, you know, we've built cars for 100 years, so we know how to build a platform that's, you know, reliable and robust. And, you know, a lot of testing and validation goes into everything we do because safety is our number one concern.
All right, let's talk about safety, because if we look at this modified Fusion, there are a few things that stand out. First of all, you've got a rack of cameras around the top, and then you've got 2 LiDAR systems. How many sensors do you really need? What's the bare minimum to make a safe self-driving vehicle?
So if you're out on the roadway and I say to you, you know, feel free to check out of the driving experience, I have to be able to handle everything you can handle and then some. And, you know, when you're looking at traffic scenarios, things can come from anywhere around the vehicle. You could have a merge ramp back over your, you know, shoulder. You could have cars intersecting at an angle. So effectively, you really do need to see 360 degrees around the car. You need complete situational awareness. And no one sensor is without some deficiency. So we have multi-mode sensor modalities on this car. We use traditional radar systems. We use cameras that you're referring to on the roof. We use LiDAR. We leverage any prior information we have about the world around us. In particular, we make 3D maps of everything we drive through. So when we come back, we know what it should look like. And if it doesn't, that prompts us to be a little bit, more alert to what's going on. So you need that sort of fidelity of lots of systems, lots of extra information to make really smart decisions.
Now, I'm not sure if the audience can see it, but right above us are actually screens that show what the vehicle is seeing in real time. Tell me, what's the magic? What's the process of turning that, what the car can see, into how it should act? Because this is the part that's always puzzled me about self-driving cars. I can't think of every scenario a vehicle might be in at any given time, and yet I might have to program for that. I might have to account for a motorcycle that's out of spec and a little bit too low, or account for a car that can't quite be seen by the regular cameras. So, you know, as a project manager, what are the problems that keep you up at night that you think we need to solve this, we need to tackle this before we let this off into the road?
Well, you've asked me like about 5 really great questions, and I'd like to answer them all. So let's start with the scenarios. If I asked you what's the weirdest thing that ever happened in your lifetime of driving, I can guarantee you it won't be the same as mine or anyone else's in the audience. And yet we have to be robust to any of those scenarios that anyone could ever encounter. So, you know, we have to get out on the road and, you know, experience all of these potential driving scenarios. Now, you know, that being said, some of them fall into generic categories. And, you know, I'll give you an example that maybe is a weird one that I've seen. I was on the freeway, prize horses in a trailer in front of me. The bottom rusted out. They fell through the trailer and horse meat got thrown on my car. Now, I don't think many of the software programmers would write, if horse meat, then do this. But generically, it's road debris in the highway. So we would want a system that can generically handle a whole category of things that would be road debris. And so that would be sort of the scenario of a testing matrix things that we would look at. And we would try to make sure that we encompass all the things that you and I as a human driver in a whole lifetime would see on the road. To other parts of your question here, I don't know if you want to prompt me on...
What are the things that keep you up at night? When you think of what steps do I need to take before I can go to Ford and say, it's ready, what would be the big bullet point items?
So I would say, again, to the exhaustive testing to make sure that you've covered all the scenarios. In addition to that, we're doing something very ambitious here. You know, we're trying to basically replace the functionality of a human being in a car. And that includes our sensing and our decision-making. And, that's quite challenging. And the sensing as part of that is, quite frankly, not something that the supply chain has been asked to do in the past. So we're asking people to make LIDARs and supercomputers that haven't typically been found on cars and to do it at the same pace that we're developing our algorithms and platform. So, you know, getting those two to merge on the same time scale is going to be a challenge.
All right, now I've got to ask the big question, because everyone out there wants to know, when do I get my self-driving car? What kind of timeline are we looking at? And realistically, are we looking at this the wrong way? The owner of our network, Leo Laporte, often says that when we look at self-driving technology, what it really should be is it's assistive technology. It helps us be better drivers, it helps us be safer drivers, and it's willing to take control when we do something stupid. So how should we look at this tech, and when is it really going to land into the lap of the average driver?
So let's be clear here. On the car that we're looking at in the background, this one is aimed at what the industry would call level 4 autonomy, which is full autonomy with no human intervention. So I'm not going to necessarily be in that realm where I need your assistance. That's a difficult proposition to drive the car for, you know, tens or hundreds or thousands of miles and then like that say, hey, I give up, it's your turn. It's not a fair proposition. So in that vein, we anticipate, and we've announced previously, that in 21 that we'll release a commercial application of a level 4 self-driving car. And most likely in that time frame, what will be containable will be a fleet service, either ride share or ride hailing or package delivery, something where you have a little bit more control over the vehicles. You get them back every day, you make sure the sensors are calibrated, you make sure they're well maintained, the maps are up to date, everything's fresh. Things that you can't guarantee when you sell a product to someone who may go away and you never see them again.
James, just one last question. If you were to speak to our audience and talk to, we've got some extreme geeks out there, and tell them what they should be thinking as they consider a self-driving car going into 2021, what would it be? What would be those words of wisdom? What would be that little bit of experience that you want to hand on as to what they should be looking for and what trends they should be tracking?
Well, you know, when I got into this project, we participated in these challenges sponsored by DARPA. And the idea was that we thought if we could make a car that drove itself, we could probably make a car that was safer. And we didn't really realize that we could actually make a car that drove itself until we did it. And now that we're at that point in time, a whole host of other things come along with the car just driving itself. You have the potential for mobility for people that are elderly, disabled, young, maybe can't afford a car. We can reduce congestion in the cities, improve fuel economy. A whole number of wonderful applications has opened up once you crack the ability to drive the car. So that's what people should be looking for is, you know, once they get it, it'll have, you know, not only the function of driving itself, but a lot of other things that come with it.
James, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your experience. And thank you for everything you've done to bring Ford to this point. Folks, if you're looking for the ultimate self-driving car, maybe you should start with a company that actually knows how to make a car.
I'd agree with that.
Ryan, after a long week at CES, there always has to be that question of, well, what was cool? What was interesting? And this is a weird year because there are a lot of years where there's not a lot of announcements that fascinate. There's not a lot that really gets me excited, and I would consider it a dud of a show. This year, there wasn't a lot of huge announcements, but I saw the maturation of technologies that have been following for a while and sort of the convergence. You've got Internet of Things combined with this whole idea of having everything connected. And I like that. I like where it is. But the big question is, what do you take away? If you could take one gadget, one product, one piece of technology from the show, anywhere, unveiled, showstoppers, PepCon, the show floor, what would it be?
Okay, so this is my first year at CES, so I don't have a lot of background, you know, history of knowing what there was to expect. But I think what you were saying with the IoT and Alexa merging, I think we're starting to see wearables and health are getting to the point where it's not just tracking your steps or your heart rate. My favorite thing I saw was the wristband watch that will check your glucose.
From PK Vitality.
Exactly. Yeah. We saw that unveiled. That was the first night we were here. And obviously that plays close to my heart because I am a type 1 diabetic. And if I don't have to use test strips, like I don't have to physically break my skin and have a dollop of blood on my finger to check my glucose. And it's also you don't have to replace it for a month and because test strips are expensive.
They are.
And yep. So is this little capsule that fits into this wristband. But the fact that I could check my blood sugar as many times as I want without having to replace it would be a game changer for me.
And without pain. Because, you know, even though it's a small pain and people know what it feels like, nobody likes poking themselves. No one likes causing themselves pain.
No.
And so what ends up happening is you test your blood sugar level once, twice a day?
No, maybe? Like four or five times
four
a day.
Four or five times. Well, what if you could do that every time you drink, every
right.
time you take a snack, every time you get back from a walk? I mean, that's really what you should be doing, and now you can do it without the pain because you push the button and it takes 20 seconds.
And I think one of the more innovative things of that product was that not only will it test your glucose, but you could switch it out for different models or modules, and then if you're an athlete, they say that you can track your lactose levels. So I see it in the future that maybe there'll be multi compartments, and you
right.
can test a lot of different things without ever actually having to take a drop of blood.
Yeah. For me, I'm going to be lazy because it was the product that I loved last year.
It's so that, sexy.
That Razer Blade Stealth. Mm-hmm. A 7th gen Kaby Lake processor, i7, 16 gigabytes of memory, 1 terabyte of SSD, PCIe connected. So we're talking crazy fast, not
right.
limited to SATA 3. That 14-inch 4K beautiful
touch screen,
illuminated keyboard, all in a 2.5 pound yeah. package that's half an inch thick for $1,000. I mean, I love my Acer. I would probably be looking at getting an Acer Spin 7 because I
yeah.
like that. But, I mean, if I wanted something and I had about $1,000 to spend, that would probably be the one to get.
I'm totally with you. When I'm looking for a laptop, that checks all the marks because yeah. it's small, it's light, because as much as I love gaming on the go, I don't yep. want a giant monster PC that I have to carry around. And those are really well made. The matte black looks nice. The keyboards look really great with the backlit LED colors and everything. And then also I like the fact that you can do the accessories
yes.
with like the GPU separate. So you carry that around with you, take it back to like the hotel room or something, do some serious editing with a GTX like attachment.
And actually I'm thinking that would be the perfect unit to do our upcoming build your own Surface. I mean, because you could put the dock with the monitor, have everything plugged in there, the Ethernet, the whole thing. One cable goes from the dock to the laptop, provides the laptop with power, plus gives the laptop the power of a actual desktop, like a 1080 GTX.
Mm-hmm.
That would be cool. That would be sweet. And, I mean, altogether, including the dock and a really expensive video card, you're looking at maybe $1,600, $1,700. That's
yeah.
completely doable for a gaming Surface that can go mobile.
So I've been needing a new editing machine. I haven't had a work laptop in a while. Do you
Leo.
Think, Leo, huh?
Uncle Leo, maybe? I don't know.
It's very affordable, I swear.
Yes, totally. Now, folks, we know that this was a lot of information. This was so much fun for us, and we love putting this together for you. Don't forget that we have so much more coverage from CES 2017. Just go to twit.tv/specials. Also, you're going to find our coverage in Home Theater Geeks. You're going to find us on the new Screensavers, in Tech News Today, and, of course, in Know How. We're going to be bringing you all the little segments that we didn't show you because, well, we had so much fun. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And now that you know how,
go to CES. Or if you can't, watch our stuff.